Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes James Abbott, director and curator of Evergreen Museum. His book, Evergreen, is an intimate portrayal of one of Baltimore's best Gilded Age mansions, a city landmark. Thursday, November 16th at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or 410-377-2966. The Ivy Bookshop. The right book is waiting.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rogics, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 324, for Thursday, November 16th, 2017. Today, crime and law enforcement in Baltimore, a good book recommendation, and a challenge to Maryland's only Republican in Congress.
It just needed to be done because we had to have somebody serious that was going to put the effort forth and launch a real bid against Andy Harris. The guy is as far right as you get. And I know it's a conservative district, but it's not like that. He's not representing most of the people. He's representing the fringe right.
That is the voice of Allison Galbraith, a young woman from Harford County who wants to be the Democratic candidate to challenge Representative Andy Harris, the first district incumbent in next year's midterm elections. We'll hear from Allison Galbraith in a few minutes. We'll also get a book recommendation from our critic, Paula Gallagher. First, Mayor Catherine Pugh joins us to talk about the very serious problem of violent crime in Baltimore. Just a day after a Locust Point man was shot to death in a robbery in South Baltimore, a Baltimore police detective, an 18-year veteran of the city's force, was shot while on duty late Wednesday afternoon on a West Baltimore street known for drug dealing and violence. I'm producing this podcast Thursday morning, and as of this hour, the detective is reported in grave condition at the Maryland Shock Trauma Center. He was shot in the head. Baltimore's police commissioner, Kevin Davis, has so far not released the detective's name, but said he is a husband and the father of two. My colleagues in the Sun newsroom use the adjective unrelenting to describe the violence in Baltimore, and beleaguered to describe city residents at this point in a surge of violence that has lasted 2.5 years. Wednesday morning, the mayor of Baltimore, Catherine Pugh, called me to complain about a comment I made about her in my Sun column. She bristled at the suggestion that she was slow moving on crime after taking office almost a year ago. While Pugh and her administration certainly needed space to develop a strategy to deal with crime, I would note that she won the city's Democratic primary in April 2016. That essentially meant she would be the city's next mayor in heavily Democratic Baltimore. It's my personal opinion that she should have hit the ground running with a crime plan, clearly stated and emphasized for the public on the day she took the oath of office. The mayor had a strong reaction to that criticism, so I invited her to the studio yesterday to talk about crime in the city and the police department. We recorded the conversation Wednesday afternoon, about an hour before the shooting of the detective in West Baltimore. We hit on several things: recruitment of new police officers, the breaking of a hiring freeze in the BPD, Catherine Pugh's desire to fund a program to break the cycle of criminality among young men. She refers to that program in the interview as ROCA, R-O-C-A. We also talked about her effort to get more money to expand the Safe Streets program. I started by asking about the mayor's declaration last week that crime is out of control, and about her order that representatives of some 30 city agencies meet every morning at police headquarters to collaborate on reducing crime. 7. So I haven't talked to you for a while, but I had a question about something from just last week. The announcement you made calling all hands on deck on crime in Baltimore, the heads of representatives of 30 city agencies to meet with the police every day to discuss the crime problem and what can be done about it. You also revived CityStat. Absolutely. During the summer. So why do you need both? That was a question I had. Because CityStat sort of operates like that, doesn't it?
In a sense, it does. But what this actually does is it puts people right directly across from each other. City agencies have been working for, you know, probably decades to solve problems that have been identified by police departments. But it doesn't happen immediately. In fact, with my Bloomberg team, what we identified was that it was taking 4 to 7 weeks sometimes to solve some of the issues that were being presented through the police department, sometimes through a city council person. So it was my opinion that, and this is through our research and analysis, that if we put people directly across from each other, A, they develop relationships, and we would speed up the process. And so what has happened is what would take 4 to 7 weeks to get done now takes a day or a day and a half.
Well, how is CityStat functioning? I mean, this is a data-driven way of the police and other agencies to look at what's going on in the city.
Exactly.
Right?
So what we've done, we call it CityStat Smart, Sustainable Solutions. We've hired Kendra Pollack and her team, a couple of data scientists, to look at how we measure success and how we become more transparent and how agencies can look at what they're doing, what they're accomplishing on a regular basis. And so they come before us in CityStat, and we might be looking at a particular problem. Everybody wants a police officer on their street. And so immediately, I think it was in December, when I took office, one of the things I looked at very closely was where are we with our police department? We had frozen under the previous administration police hiring at a time when, after Freddie Gray, as you well know, we were losing more police officers than we were able to hire. I said we must, one of my first actions, one of my first call to actions was to the police department to hire in every single vacancy. Hire immediately, as quickly as you can.
How many vacancies do we have that are funded?
Close to probably about 400 or 500 now, about 400 now.
That we could fund?
We fund not, well, let me just tell you what we did first. So first what we did was we identified folks who were already in the police department who we could civilianize their positions. So that turned out to be about 100 people.
Okay.
So that put 100 additional police officers on the streets. And now I think we have about 200 vacancies that can still be filled. Because when I said in December, early January, that we must fill every position and we must hire police officers as quickly as we can, that process began. So what we also learned with my Bloomberg team looking at the process, and I said to the police department, how long does it take to get someone through the process? So at that time, it was taking 9 months just to get through the process. I'm not talking about the training.
You're talking about the academy.
No, I'm talking about background checks. And drugs, all of that analysis, and all of those things. 9 months is what they were previously doing. So I said, I need it to be less, because if you put that 9 months on top of 1 year's of training, that's 21 months before a police officer trained hits the streets of the city.
So where are we now with that?
So we're now at 6 months, and then we
6 months for the background?
6 months for the background check, and now we'll be at 3 months, because what I charge my team with is, what are we doing technology-wise that is slowing down this process? So the new process that we're putting in place will streamline what was once a 9-month interview background check down to about 3 months. And so then you put that on top of the 12 months that you have to spend in the academy, because that is state law. So that gives you 12 plus 3, that's 15 months. So
you've knocked 6 months off of it.
Yes.
How are you doing in terms of recruitment, applications? What does that look like?
Highest ever. At one stage or another, we're about 184 officers in the academy, probably about 150 right now, because 30-something have hit the streets. And so if you
At one point we had 184,
so? More than we've ever had since 2004. This is the first year since 2004 that we passed the attrition rate. We were losing more officers than we were hiring. This
through
is the first year.
Retirement or resignation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is the first year, according to our data, the first year that we've been able to surpass the attrition rate. So we have more folks applying to be police officers. And I don't know if you know this, but in my last year in the Senate, I passed legislation giving every jurisdiction, enabling legislation to provide $2,500 per police officer for tax credits to live in the city. Our city council just passed that legislation, so we put
that in. I did know that from reading the Baltimore
Sun. Right. So we put that in place as well. So if you do the math, we've been in office, I think, now 11 months, be 12 months on December the 6th. So even with the call of action, those police officers, you won't see the benefit of those officers probably for another 6 to 8 months. And that was, and that's why that was my top and major priority when I first came in and said to the council, we can't afford to cut police officers out of the budget in this. We cannot afford to take away those positions. Those positions need to stay in the budget. We need to fill every single empty position, and we need to get, because people want police officers walking the streets of our city, not auxiliary police officers. They want police officers well trained on the streets of our city.
And the commissioner put more officers on the street.
Yes,
the 100. The existing officers who were doing other things, he put them on
the
street.
Absolutely. We identified quickly 100 officers and put them on the streets.
Speaking of the commissioner, Commissioner Davis, so when you talk to him about what's going on, so a citizen of the city, such as myself, would say, 300 plus homicides again this year. We've had these, you know, incidents involving juveniles recently that got a lot of attention in the news, as they should. What's going on? Like, why? So, why this, you know, the surge in violence goes back before you became mayor. It goes back to 2015, just actually it goes back a couple months before the Freddie Gray period. What's going on? I mean, like, what do they say? What does he say? Okay, is there an explanation?
Well, let me just say, first of all, we should be very clear. Looking at violence across the state, violence is not just up in Baltimore. It's up in Baltimore County. It's up in Harford County. It's up around the country. And juvenile violence in this city is out of control because people think there are no consequences for their actions, which is why when I met with the governor and talked about the technology needs and the needs of the city, I asked for certain things. I asked for ROCA, a program that focuses just on juveniles, because we have so many juveniles who are, one, disobeying the law, juveniles who are in drug-addicted families, juveniles who are homeless in the city, and they need particular attention and things that need to be done with them.
Hey, so, I'm with you on this. I'm just wondering, I mean, what do you get when you talk to Commissioner Davis?
They want
Is it because of the opioid crisis?
Part of it is the opioid crisis.
What
not,
is it?
Not just because of them, but because of their families. And, you know, everybody's scrambling, trying to get money. The young man who was just killed up on
Key Highway,
a mother, a boyfriend, and a son.
Were arrested?
Just arrested. In Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
In Georgia.
We are recording this on Wednesday afternoon, and we are just getting news about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is crazy. And so I believe in accountability. If you were to read the editorial of the New York police commander who talked about, is Baltimore doing certain things? Everything that he suggested we do, we're doing. But he also said that you've got to be bold around the laws that you put in place. And we put legislation before the council to curb some of the gun violence on our streets, which was watered down by the council. 89% of the individuals who commit crimes in this city have been in contact with the criminal justice system 9 to 11 times. The man who was shot on Emerson, who was managing the store on Emerson Avenue,
mm-hmm.
left 11 children. I saw the video. When they turned and shot him in the head and the blood ran down the floor, they didn't even look back. He had already committed a murder once before in April of that
season. The one who was arrested.
Absolutely. Mm. And so this lack of punishment for folks who are committing violent crimes on our streets, and the number of illegal guns that are in our city are out of control. There was a time when somebody would smack somebody. Now we pull out a gun and we shoot you. It's just not acceptable.
Oh, part of the problem with guns, as we reported the other day, is because of the corruption of the gun task force. That's part of the reason. There's a lot of guns available, but their arrests are down because of that, in part. That's on that unit that's now disbanded.
But we have put together another unit that's focused on gun violence. And so what folks need to know is, one, every time somebody is shot, every time somebody is killed, every time a fire breaks out in this city, I am more than alarmed. I am so focused on violence reduction in this city. You know, it's not even about sleep at this point. You know, I tell people this phone dings every time something happens in this city. And I'm extremely concerned. And that's why when I did my first call to action back in January, I said to people in the city, I can't do this work by myself. And in that meeting, 100 people came representing about 30 groups every other week in City Hall. Those 30 groups still meet with me. The Nation of Islam, walking the streets in Park Heights Avenue, making sure that they become disruptors in the violence that is existing on the streets of our city. Number of groups and organizations. You know, I walk up and down the city streets, you know, and when I walk up and down the city streets, they know me because they know that I'm very concerned about the problems that we're facing. I stood on Pennsylvania Avenue for 4 hours listening to folks' problems and participated with my call to action group, walking, knocking door to door, communicating with folks, trying to find out what their needs are. We surveyed certain parts of the city. We're doing it all across the city. And then what we do after that is we bring resources to those neighborhoods and those communities. I've got a mobile unit moving in and out of neighborhoods, trying to help people get jobs because I know that too is a problem in our city.
Speaking of disruptors, I noticed in your announcement last week that you wanted to raise some money, some $10 million for Safe Streets. And yes. Safe Streets is a program that I believe in. I certainly have advocated for it in the newspaper. Is there money available for that without asking?
We put additional monies in our budget.
But what about the governor? The governor said he wants to help.
We've put money in the state budget for it as well. Every street in the city should be a safe street. It's not just about targeting a specific area. That's why we're looking at expanding it. That's why we're putting more dollars into Safe Streets. That's why we're going to the private sector. That's why I'm putting more money into it.
That's what got me to the question about the governor, because the governor has said he wants to help. So I wonder, what have you gotten out of the governor?
I got $2 million to put computers in our cars. In 1998, I didn't read a story that Baltimore City didn't get computers in their cars. You know, I didn't read it in 2008 that Baltimore City didn't get computers in their cars, or 2015. We haven't had computers in our cars. They've had them in Montgomery County and Prince George's County that long. I went to the governor and got $2 million to put computers in our cars so that our officers can do their work. And so between now and January, there'll be computers in every car of the police department.
Okay. What about Safe Streets?
I already said Safe Streets is already being expanded. We put another $3 million in the budget for the state and another $3 million.
You're getting it from the state, $3 million?
We put it in the state's budget.
You mean you're asking for it?
Yes, exactly. In my meeting with the governor, among the things that I asked for was the parole and probation officers in every police district. We had gotten down to 2 parole and probation officers for the entire police districts. And so now the governor immediately gave us the 2 individuals in East Police District in the city and another 200 parole and probation officers in the city of Baltimore, because it helps the police department when we're trying to go out and pick up people on warrants and so forth.
What can citizens expect in the coming months? I know what your hope would be. The commissioner has a plan in place. It seems like he's done a lot of the correct things, putting more officers on the street, for instance.
But not enough police officers on the street. There are not enough police officers on the street.
So is that our problem? We just don't have enough cops?
I think that is part of our problem. We've got to work more to make sure that our juveniles and our young people in our city have constructive things to do. We've opened up our rec centers on Friday nights to 11 o'clock, on Saturday nights till midnight. I've been through those rec centers. I was up at Park Heights this weekend.
Do they use them? Do they want them?
They're using them, absolutely. And I asked the young people, and this is part of it is the age group that we want there. 16-year-olds, they've got a basketball league going on now in the rec centers. Upstairs, the young people using computers, doing computer games, young women learning how to do hair, young women also learning how to do, we're going to put coding in the rec centers. We're also doing a drone camp in the rec centers, a STEM cell program in the rec centers. So we're focused on what we need to do to occupy the minds of our young people.
I have one more question about the young people and the school's role in this. If certain students are not in school or are frequently not in school, then that could be a sign of trouble. Do we have enough personnel to recognize that and to act on it?
Yeah, I am the mayor of the city. You have a CEO of the school system. And I feel very responsible every day for what happens in our schools. And so I have a great partnership with Dr. Sandra Leeses. And what I've said to her is that we need accountability for every single child in our school system. And for example, we raised $16 million, $16 million so that 9,000 young people could go to work this summer. That's more than ever in our city. And then I raised another $200,000 and invested in about 14 young people who are in business. Then I created Squeegee Corps for young people to try to get these young people off of these corners and into a mentoring program, and we're working on that because some of them are really suffering, but at the same time, some of them are just too violent to even be on those corners, and so they need some assistance. So what I've said to Dr. Sandalise is, along with Kendra Pollack and our data scientists, we will track every single student. We need to know that when it is time for them to graduate, A, they're prepared to either go to work, go to college, or go into a program that can help them to get to where they need to go. And so we made Baltimore City Community College free. And people say, how could you do that? Because about 60% of those young people could go free anyway if they just filled out their FAFSA form. So as a result of that, what we're doing is having FAFSA weekends, FAFSA nights, the colleges and universities.
Have you already started doing that?
Yep, we're working on
that. What kind of a turnout have you had for those?
No, we're scheduling
that. Oh, you're scheduling them now.
We're scheduling that now, yeah. Because we need, and we're going to have people working with them. I said this with Dr. Sandalise, we've got to help these young people because, you know, they are the future of our city. And so we've got to make sure that we're doing everything right by them.
She mentioned that one problem is that some kids have already dropped out of school.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you got to focus on the ones who are still in.
Well, that's what the ROCA program does. That's the 16 to 24-year-old program that we're trying to get funded through the state.
And what would that do?
That focuses on trying to help those young people get beyond or get back in school, get their GED, get into a training program, and we want to concentrate on working with them as well. So, for example, working with Vehicles for Change, we're doing automotive training with them. Returning citizens are getting that help too. But we don't want them to be a part of the criminal justice system, and that's why we're reaching out. Whether they're standing on the corners or they're, you know, sitting on the sidewalk, we need to be asking the question, what are you doing? In our Office of Employment Development, we have a mobile unit now moving throughout the neighborhoods and communities. But what has happened with this new initiative is that they now have computers on their back. They're walking up to you and say, yeah, and their signs on their back, need a job, ask me. And when the fire department is going out and putting smoke detectors in people's homes and knocking on those doors, they're following with them and asking, does anybody here need help? Do you need a job? We did the first Baltimore Works program at the convention center. 4,000 people showed up. Our own Department of Human Resources. I know because we hired, I went to walk through there. I couldn't even get through without people saying, thank you for doing this. We've never had nothing like this before. But we, in my own city hall, we hired about 4 people from there. So I know people got hired, and we're looking forward to doing it again this year.
Do you have full confidence still in Commissioner Davis?
I have confidence in Commissioner Davis. I have confidence in the people that I've surrounded myself with. I have confidence in my Bloomberg team. I thank Michael Bloomberg for making us a Bloomberg City. I'm putting up 6,000 new lights in Baltimore City. I'm changing out every light bulb in the city to LED lights so they can shine better on the streets. We're getting technology with our new set of lights, working with Bloomberg throughout the city that will have intelligence attached to it as well, so that, you know, we'll be able to detect some of the problems that we're having in our city. Gunshot detection is important for our city. License plate readers, which is also in the governor's budget coming up. But I'm thankful for all of the philanthropic organizations that have come together to support the efforts. And I'm still asking for more money, and I will continue to ask. And I will not sleep. I will not be satisfied until we reduce violence in this city.
Mayor Pugh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find a link to Mayor Catherine Pugh's plan for reducing crime in the notes of this podcast. For the latest news about the shooting of the city detective and other crime-related stories, check the Sun's website at baltimoresun.com. Coming up, a quick book review, and then we meet Allison Galbraith, a Democratic candidate who wants to challenge Representative Andy Harris's hold on Maryland's 1st District seat. Paula Gallagher's recommendation this week is a novel by Louise Erdrich called Future Home of the Living God.
Louise Erdrich is a celebrated literary novelist, and whenever she has a book coming out, usually maybe one a year, it really is an event. And this novel is a departure for her. She always writes about Native American characters in those settings, and she's sticking to her native Minnesota here. So it's realistic fiction, you think, but no, there's a twist.
This is a kind of speculative fiction, almost that post-apocalyptic future, and we get some hints of what's going on here. This young woman was adopted by a white couple, a well-off couple in Minnesota, and she's looking for her birth mother. And she finds out that while she's named Cedar Songmaker, that's her adopted name, her actual name is really Mary Potts. A little bit of a disappointment. But she's going to see her mother because she is with child. Cedar is pregnant, and the whole story is told in a diary format. This is a United States that's sealed off from the rest of the world. It's headed by a totalitarian government. The church and state have become one. There are food shortages, and there's a religious fanaticism that has overtaken everyone. And the scariest, if that's not scary enough, evolution is now moving backward. And so there are no healthy or very few healthy, normal babies being born. And so the government encourages citizens to turn in pregnant women or pregnant women to turn themselves in. And so this is a novel that, of course, is going to be likened to The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. We have another literary writer writing this kind of speculative, scary new world. So the comparisons to that book are inevitable. It's a novel of big ideas. It's a novel of worry. As if we need another thing to keep us up at night, this book will do it. It lacks the world building of Margaret Atwood's novel. However, it certainly amps up that anxiety as the character is struggling with themes of identity, of family secrets, of religion, and what might happen in this new totalitarian government and science gone wrong. Again, it's Future Home of the Living God by Louise Erdrich.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian in the Baltimore County Public Library System, and she joins us about once a week to recommend a new book for our listeners. She'll be back with another review next week. Now, Allison Galbraith. She is 34 years old, a native of Harford County, a self-employed mother of a 10-year-old boy. A Democrat and resident of Maryland's 1st Congressional District, Allison Galbraith disagrees with the current representative of that district, Andy Harris, on a lot of issues, starting with his dogged opposition to the Affordable Care Act. A recent look at the ACA in Harris's 1st Congressional District by The Sun found that the law has had a significant impact. Census data show the number of uninsured residents in the 1st District, which includes the Eastern Shore, as well as portions of Baltimore and Harford counties, fell from 63,000 in 2013 to 29,000 2 years later, a 54% drop in the uninsured. And yet, the 1st District is considered red. The nine counties that make up the Eastern Shore supported Donald Trump in last year's election with 58% of the vote. Shore voters also have backed Andy Harris with resounding margins. But into that goes Allison Galbraith. Today, she tells a little about herself and what she offers voters of the 1st District. We start by asking what motivated her to challenge Andy Harris. And as you'll hear, it has everything to do with his opposition to the Affordable Care Act.
So I own a business, and the only reason that I can own that business without access to a spouse's health insurance policy is the ACA, because the essential health benefits said that you could no longer charge women more for health insurance. Prior to ACA, they were charged 30 to 80% more. And also, it forced them to cover pre-existing conditions, which in my case were pregnancy-related and not chronic, but try telling an insurance company that.
Mm-hmm.
So after the election, I went to Harris's office and I sort of worked my way up his staff from his constituent liaison to his health care, legislative aide, and then finally to Harris himself saying, I have a business. My business operates out of District 1. My business is the only thing that allows me to balance having a 10-year-old son, being a single mom, and then also being a caregiver to aging parents. And when I finally met him, I knew I needed to keep it short. So I just asked him, do you promise to vote against any legislation that allows for gender rate hikes? And he looked at me and he said, well, I don't think most people would mind if women paid more for health insurance.
He actually said that to you?
He actually said that to me, yes, and there were witnesses. He said that we have needs that that men don't. And so it was fair to pay a little bit more.
Did you respond when he said that?
Yeah, I said, women mind. He said that, well, women need services that men don't need. And I said, without women, men wouldn't even be in this world. You know, eventually he just moved on to the next question, which was my 10-year-old sitting there asking about, are there going to be cuts to coverage of maternity care? And I believe it was about H.R. 610, which was the school choice bill, which goes and repeals all of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act and all of the accountability standards for our public school system at the same time. And he basically just told my son, no, you have nothing to worry about. But if you actually go through his legislation and his votes, there's quite a lot to worry about. A couple of days later, my mother passed away. And my business was not about profit for me. It was about balancing my caregiving responsibilities with being a mother and home life, personal life, which I think is a reason that a lot of people start a business. And when she passed away, she'd spent her life fighting for healthcare for all and to end racial disparities in healthcare. And she didn't care whose feathers she ruffled. She was out to help her students. That was number one. She started the nursing program at Morgan State and the health systems management program at UB. And I looked at her, a woman like that, who spent her whole career fighting to help people. And the only reason I was able to help her is because of ACA allowing me to finally buy a private policy and have my own business and gave me that flexibility. And I thought, if this is what Congress is, then we need to change Congress. If I'm going to have to go look for an employer-based job, then I might as well take Andy's. I graduated from Bel Air High School. And then I went to college I got an associate's degree at Hartford Community College, where my dad taught for 45 years. And then I went on to University of Maryland, College Park.
What did you study there?
Philosophy.
Oh, and what did you do with that?
What did I do? I went to go work for Department of Defense. I started out at the lowest of the low at Aberdeen Test Center, just tracking and reporting on testing there. And then I worked my way up to a tech writer, and then I worked my way up to the 2-star staff levels, always as a contractor. Gotta give that disclosure. I'm a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because my degree was in philosophy and people don't really take that seriously in a science and technology or research and development world, I started picking up all sorts of other professional certifications. So logistics or systems engineering, test and evaluation, contracting, budgeting, finance, across the board, I had a thorough understanding of exactly how Department of Defense operates and how they're running their research and development programs, and also what their problems are in there. Employers do not always take so kindly to employees getting phone calls in the middle of the day saying, your mother's had a stroke, your mother's in the hospital, you need to go take care of this, you need to deal with this or that, and it causes a lot of problems. The protections aren't there for contractors. They get a bad rap, and some of it's justified, some of it's not. Anyway, I got laid off about a month after my mom had several strokes, and I said, you know what, I'll just go ahead and I'll start my own business, and I can do consulting. And so about 30 hours a week, 25, 30 hours a week, I still consult for Department of Defense. And then the rest of the time, I help small businesses, usually service-disabled, veteran-owned businesses, bid on federal contracts. You know, I told my mom before she passed away that I was thinking about it. Somebody had joked that I should run as a Republican in that district. And my mom looked at me and said, oh, Allison.
Yeah.
They can gerrymander us away and they can abandon us both physically and financially. That doesn't mean that the people there don't deserve a voice. We need to have a voice. And when I tell my son that if you see an injustice in this world, if you see something that you don't like, that you think is wrong, go ahead and fix it, I intend to lead by example. It just needed to be done because we had to have somebody serious that was going to put the effort forth and launch a real bid against Andy Harris. The guy is as far right as you get. And I know it's a conservative district, But it's not like that. He's not representing most of the people. He's representing the fringe right. There's some confusion between Obamacare versus ACA. I hear people say that they don't like Obamacare, they do like ACA. And I've also seen the same with Medicaid, which in Maryland is known as Health Choice. I had a friend who was complaining about the subsidies and, you know, the differences in her insurance between 2010 and now. She'd just done her taxes. She's in a real state about it. And I finally started asking questions. And I said, well, was it employer provided? And she said, no. And I dug a little more. Long story short, it was Medicaid. Except she had always called it Health Choice. She had no idea
that it was Medicaid.
Right.
Yeah.
I want the government to put people first. I'm sick of it being about donors or big money or somebody pulling strings and being puppet masters in there. The job of a representative is to listen and to advocate on behalf of their representatives. That's not what he's doing at all, at all. And if you look across the issues, he's terrible almost across the board, even in terms of financial, you know, he claims to be a fiscal conservative. I won't call myself a fiscal conservative, but I will say that I do value fiscal responsibility. And that's part of what I do. I'm the person who gets a lot of the phone calls going, oh, well, this program needed $5 million a year, except they received $3 million of it. How do they operate? I'm the person that goes through the acquisition process and figures out what's a regulation, what's statute, what can you get away with waiving or find a better way to streamline this program. He's claiming to be a fiscal conservative. Meanwhile, he's shutting down the government at an expense of $10 billion to the economy over his pet projects. There's nothing financially responsible about him. So it's all issues with him. Everywhere you look, it's something that's bad for everyday people.
On this issue of the district itself and its political makeup, its voter registration, and, you know, stemming from gerrymandering of the district, people will say, well, it's a red district. She doesn't have a chance. I've heard people say this, you know. So what's your response to that when you look at the map?
There are more than enough independents to flip this district. It is not as bad as people would think. People often think that the Eastern Shore is the more problematic area for Democrats. It's not. The Eastern Shore is actually purple. And then you look at Harford County and Carroll County and the parts of Baltimore County that are lumped in there, and that's actually where the heavy numbers of Republicans are coming in. But it's also where I'm from. I'm from Harford County. I grew up there. And I operate in an industry where you have to be able to talk to people across the aisle anyway and deal with politics at higher levels of DOD.
You don't think the district is as conservative as Andy Harris is?
No, I do not. Not for a second.
And it's just instinctual, or it comes from talking to people as you move around?
Both. One, there's no logic to what Harris is doing aside from you go through his donors. And that's going to give you the answer of how he's voting. People don't want that. People want a representative who listens to them and works for them. They don't want somebody who works for their donors.
Allison, have you had any contact with the Maryland Democratic Party in terms of your race, campaign?
I've met with them, yes.
What's come of that? Anything? Because you would need some help there, wouldn't you?
I do not expect a lot of assistance from them prior to the primary. That's the general message that I'm getting from them. And I said, fine, the people will do it for themselves. And we will.
And what about after the primary?
We'll see what they do.
It's 2018. It's an interesting year. I mean, the Democratic Party structure in Maryland was, you know, you could look at them and say, well, you're conceding the first district if you don't get behind a candidate, support a candidate against Andy Harris.
To be fair to them, they are finally out there canvassing and they're talking about the Democratic Party out there in District 1. There is a presence out in District 1. My grief with it was you can't rah-rah Democrats your way to a win in this district. They have to know the candidates' names so that they can get to know the candidates. And you're not going to flip 45,000 voters between June and November of next year. So you have to start now. Letting people know there are candidates out here. and telling them their names. And I was told, oh, we can't support one candidate or another. I said, fine, hand out a form that gives everybody's name so that people know there are actually candidates here. And they said, we'll look into it. And I haven't heard back. That was months ago. We've had a couple fundraisers. We have meet and greets. I go out to events. I go out and I talk to the clubs. And I've been working my way through the DCCs. I, in particular, being technically a millennial, have gone and talked to the college kids. And when I go out there, I actually invite the college Republicans clubs to come out and speak to me also and say, why do you think young people haven't been involved in this process? Because we're going to be the ones cleaning this up in 30 years, and there are five millennials in Congress right now. It's not a matter of capability. It's a matter of the system being very difficult for younger, less networked, less financially well-off people to operate in. And you get a great response out of them. Sometimes I wonder if I woke up and I'm just dreaming and I turn on the TV and I can't believe this is what the country I grew up in has turned into at this point.
Yeah.
That said, I think that there's some fairness to arguments on both sides about why it occurred. I think that people did want change. I think that there's probably a lot of racism, bigotry, sexism going into it. On the other hand, living in one of these districts that Democrats have basically abandoned, I can see why Democrats aren't out there. Why are you going to back a party that's turned its back on you? Doesn't make any sense.
What do you think the Democrats' message should be? If you could sit in a room with the leadership, right? The traditional leadership, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, people like that, Tom Perez, what would you say to them? What do you think the message should be?
The message should be that the people need to come first and that we're going to have ethical government with good intentions. I think a lot more broadly, you can go a lot of ways on different issues. I think it's about the qualities of fighting for people, making sure that their interests are coming first, not having it be about corporate gains, things like that. I think that the New Deal approach that they're going with, I like that. I like a lot of tenets of it. I am an everyday person, middle class America. As I said, my business was never about profit for me. It was about flexibility for my family. So when you're talking about, you know, somebody has a problem where their washing machine breaks and they're not sure they're going to be able to pay their rent, that's something I can relate to a lot better than most candidates that you ever see for Congress. And I feel like if you've got so much money that you are completely economically removed from what the impacts of these policies are on the everyday people, then maybe we don't need more of that in Congress. Congress lacks diversity, and I'm not just talking about gender diversity or racial or ethnic diversity, socioeconomic diversity. And I think that that is the fundamental root of a lot of these problems, is because they're so insulated from the impacts of their policy. I think we need reps who, if you go and take health care away from people, they're going to be next to you with no insurance. Look at CHIP not having been reauthorized.
For children, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I used CHIP. I used CHIP back when I couldn't buy a policy because ACA wasn't in place and I had pre-existing conditions related to pregnancy. My child was able to get MCHIP. It's such a phenomenal program, and it's so important to so many families. But if you haven't used it, maybe you're just far enough removed to justify to yourself, oh, well, we're going to use it for political leverage. No, you don't use pregnant women and children's health care for political leverage. It's disgusting. What I offer is somebody who, one, understands everyday people's problems, because I am one of the everyday people. If you're talking about healthcare, if you're talking about taxes, if you're talking about your business or whatever problem you're having in life, I'm probably having it right next to you because I am just one of the masses. I also understand how the federal government works inside and out, and my job is to find better ways to spend their money and better ways to run their processes so that it works better for the people. So I've got professional experience that would help to make the government run more efficiently, effectively. And I've got the personal experience that you need to understand who it needs to work for. And it needs to be of the people, for the people, by the people. Not of the corporation, for the corporation, by the corporation. That's not what it's supposed to be. We need the big money out. We need anti-corruption measures put in. We need ethical representatives who are going to make sure that people come first. One thing that I found that I thought was really interesting is that there are people that they disagree with me almost universally about things, except they've left me comments or notes or sent me messages saying, we like you because you're listening to us, and we haven't seen that. We want a representative who's present, who's willing to work across the aisle, as John McCain said, returning to normal order. They want to go back to the days of bipartisanship, and they want to make sure that their representative is putting their interest first. I sometimes say that my opinion on a particular issue doesn't necessarily matter. Legislation isn't black and white. Legislation is shades of gray. People want Medicare for all, but do you want Medicare for all if it costs four times as much as our current health care? No, you don't. You know, and you also have to consider political viability, legislative viability. If you can't get it through, you can't get it through. You need to have somebody who's pragmatic enough to say, well, here's my ideal, but here's what I'm going to take. And I'll get you the best deal that I can because I understand your problems and I took the time to listen to you and I really am in there trying to advocate on your behalf as a representative should be. People are very appreciative of that.
Allison, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Allison Galbraith is one of four candidates seeking the Democratic nomination to challenge Representative Andy Harris in Maryland's 1st Congressional District next year. We'll have other candidate interviews for you in the coming weeks and months. The Maryland primary is in June 2018. And that's our show for now. The producers of Roughly Speaking are Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek. This is Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.